Okay, so you think being president's a tough job? How about this one? The guy who tests sewer water for drugs. Yeah, there really is someone who does that. It happens through a process called sewer epidemiology. Think of it as a citywide urine test. Kevin Thomas is one of a group of environmental scientists in Norway who used the technology to drug test the entire city of Oslo for a full year. Kevin Thomas is with us from Oslo. Thanks for joining us.
No problem at all.
Kevin, explain to us how sewer sampling works. What are you measuring exactly?
What we're measuring are specific biomarkers of drug use. So these are the breakdown products that the body produces when someone's taken a particular drug. So for instance, for cocaine, there's a specific biomarker that we use, which is called benzolagonine. And there's even a specific biomarker that we can use, for instance, if someone's taking cocaine with alcohol, which is called cocoethylene. And what we do is we take samples of sewage effluent and we measure the levels of these biomarkers, these very specific biomarkers in the effluent.
Okay, so let's talk about this study. You took a wastewater sample every 2 weeks over the course of one entire year and you found some trends. What did you find?
I guess the most interesting trend that we found was a peak in ecstasy consumption during the two-week period that high school students in Norway party quite hard in May. And that represented around a tenfold peak in ecstasy consumption over what we'd seen over the previous 5 or 6 months. Also in kind of Christmas, New Year, that there was a peak in cocaine consumption as well.
Is that surprising? Is that something that you didn't know before you did this study?
This allows us to pinpoint exactly when it happened and the quantities that were used.
Are there any drugs that don't show up in this kind of testing?
There are some drugs which we feel that are harder to analyze using this method than others. For instance, heroin. Heroin itself is metabolized in the body to a compound called 6-MAM, and that's not very stable in sewage systems. Hmm.
Is there any way to determine whether or not you could scale this technology down, where scientists could do this in a neighborhood and identify perhaps a block where cocaine or other illegal drug use had spiked and then alert authorities and raid a house?
There's nothing to stop you using it in that way. The nice thing about the approach when you're testing large numbers of people is that it's totally anonymous. But once you get into small numbers of people, then you start being able to point fingers at individuals. And I think that's when some of the more tricky ethical questions come into play.
Privacy concerns, I imagine.
Privacy concerns, yeah.
So what's done with this data?
What this approach allows us to do is to evaluate how big the drug problem is. And what we do is we use the technique alongside the existing types of data that are accumulated, you know, things like seizures and police arrests and that sort of thing. And what we do is try and use our data to make the data that they have better.
Is the overall use of illegal substances higher than anticipated?
It is slightly higher than the official numbers, yeah.
That's Kevin Thomas. He's an environmental scientist at the Norway Institute of Water Research. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Now, sewer epidemiology is also being used in this country. Scientists in Oregon are doing the same tests to create a kind of drug map of their state. Caleb Banta Green is a drug epidemiologist at the University of Washington's Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute. He says the testing in Oregon revealed a few surprises and dispelled the myth that methamphetamine is only a problem in rural areas.
And what we saw with some data that we collected in Oregon across 96 cities was that methamphetamine was in every one of those 96 cities. It's not somebody else's problem. It's not just somewhere else. It's quite ubiquitous.
That's Caleb Banta Green with the University of Washington's Alcohol and Drug Abuse Institute. Civilization is on a collision course. That's the message Paul Gilding, the former head of Greenpeace International, is sounding in his new book. It's called The Great Disruption. The facts, as he spells them out, are frightening. Humans are using 140% of the Earth's resources. The United Nations predicts the world's population will reach 9.3 billion by the time 2050 rolls around. Fisheries are collapsing, deforestation is on the rise, and food prices have spiked again. But Paul Gilding looks at all of this gloom and doom and sees opportunity. Paul Gilding is with us from Melbourne, Australia. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here, Paul.
Great. Good to be here.
So that statistic I just rattled off from your book, that humans are using 140% of Earth's resources, explain that.
What they're calculating is how much area of land and water we would need to sustain this economy as it's currently operating. And to do that on a sustained basis would take 140% as much land and sea as there is on the Earth today. I mean, of course, like living on your credit card, that can't be maintained and the bill is coming due.
Now, we've been hearing these warnings for decades. We're using too many resources too quickly, doing lots of serious damage in the process. And then you look at all the natural disasters just in the past year, hurricanes and tornadoes, massive floods and droughts. What kinds of connections should we be making about all of this?
Look, very direct. Obviously, weather, you know, is always a challenging one. It's why there's such debate on the area, because it does vary naturally. But you look at what's happening lately in the US clearly, but also around the world in my own country, in Australia. Now, we just had floods that covered an area the size of France and Germany combined. I mean, just massive in scale. And what that says is we've now reached a tipping point in this degradation of the environment where, if you like, Mother Nature fights back. I don't mean in kind of some spiritual sense, but in terms of some basic physics, chemistry, biology. This is a system. And you do certain things to this system and it has a response. And the response of more CO2 in the atmosphere, the response of degrading fisheries, the response of, you know, cutting down too many trees and so on, is that the system changes. And those changes, they're okay for nature for a while because nature adapts to the new situation, but they're not okay for us. This is now a human economic issue that we now have sort of gone past the point of protecting nature for its own sake and moving into a very different scale.
So what do you suppose our reaction as a collective society should be? I mean, early on in your book, you quote Winston Churchill about the way earlier generations were sleepwalking into disaster. I take it you think that we're currently sleepwalking today?
Look, we are, but we're waking up. Historically, look at World War II, I think, is the prime example. Now, we don't act until the crisis hits. We don't act until the evidence is so overwhelming we have no choice left. But then we do amazing things. And that's sort of the exciting part of this, is that we can no longer avoid the crisis, but we can avoid collapse. And by the way, we normally do act when the crisis comes. And we're pretty incredible as a species once we get going. Now, before World War II, if I'd told you, you know, in 1938, 1939, that, you know, we were going to do the things that we did in World War II in terms of social change, in terms of technology change, in terms of how much money we spent. I mean, by the end of World War II, the US was spending 37% of GDP on the war effort, up from like 1.5% before it started. So just phenomenal changes and inconvenient and difficult and challenging, but still nevertheless achieved. And that's what we're capable of as a species. And we will do that when the crisis hits.
When you think about what the crisis would look like that would spur us into action to make these dramatic changes, what kind of scale are we talking about? What does that crisis look like?
It doesn't look very nice, I must say. It does look like food prices spiking to the point where we have food shortages. Obviously, extreme weather, and we're seeing that a lot. And we kind of see the extreme weather as a bit inconvenient. We're not yet seeing it as an economic issue at large scale. But if insurance companies become affected, if we get economic risk being put in the whole system as a result, that becomes a very serious impact. So I think we are going to see economic impacts of hitting the limits to growth. When I say the earth is full, what that means is we can't grow the economy much more than it is today because it simply won't fit on the planet. That's a question of physics.
So you don't seem concerned about this. You seem pretty confident that when this happens, everyone will kind of collectively recognize what has to be done?
Correct, but not smoothly. I don't want to kind of make it sound like it's all going to happen and we'll all be holding hands, you know, walking towards the future. You know, it's going to be pretty ugly at times, as it was in World War II, as it always is in a crisis. There will be arguments and debates and conflicts between countries, and we will think we won't make it at various times. Remembering, again, World War II, I think, is such a good example of what's coming, is that people weren't sure they were going to win. There was absolutely a doubt. They sort of talked a good game, but they were nervous, they were scared that they wouldn't make it through. We will be too. But what I'm saying is from history, the evidence is that we will make this and we'll work it out. The only thing that has to change is for us to end the denial that it's happening and get to work on fixing the problem.
Paul Gilding, he's the author of The Great Disruption. He joined us from Melbourne, Australia. Paul, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's bring in James Fallows now. He joins us most Saturdays for a look behind the headlines. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Rachel.
Does this vote in New York have national ramifications?
I think it does, not simply because the number of people covered by this law is now approximately double what it was before the New York vote. One significant fact is that the resolution passed last night a Republican-controlled body, even though, of course, only a few Republicans voted for it. That's significant. Second, the initiative had the support of prominent mainstream, quote-unquote, politicians, too, notably Governor Andrew Cuomo and Mayor Michael Bloomberg, which is a different feeling from previous initiatives around the country. country. There was a compromise made for religious groups with their objections, and my sense is this is the beginning of what will be a fairly rapid change of opinion and legislation around the country.
Let's move the discussion down here to Washington, where there is a high-stakes game of chicken going on between GOP leaders on one side, the Obama administration on the other, and this is all over whether or not to raise the country's debt ceiling. Republican House Majority Leader Eric Cantor actually walked out on negotiations on this. Where are the fault lines in this debate, Jim?
The fault lines, the obvious ones, are between the Republicans and the Democrats, but there's probably an equally important one within the Republican Party, which has the potential of really harmful effects for the country as a whole. Because one reading on why Majority Leader Cantor left the discussions is that he was happy to be there as long as the negotiations were about cutting spending. But as soon as any prospect whatsoever of any increase of any sort in federal revenues, including closing tax loopholes or having user fees, he just wouldn't be part of it. And that is part of his standing with the Tea Party faction of the new House Republican majority. And so if the Republicans cannot agree on any sort of revenue increase at all, the prospect for having an agreement before the deadline comes near are dark.
There's been a lot of talk this week about the economics of war after the president announced plans to start drawing down troops in Afghanistan. He made that speech earlier in the week. We talked earlier in the show about the dollars and cents of the drawdown, but Jim, talk to us about the politics of this decision and this announcement. Does the president win political points here?
I thought there were two aspects of the president's speech, apart from the actual mechanics of the withdrawal, which were significant in long-term political positioning. One was his declaring the United States as having achieved much of what it had in mind in Afghanistan after the decapitation of al-Qaeda with the killing of Osama bin Laden. The other was his argument that it was time for nation-building not just around the world, but here in the United States as well. This was an almost Dwight Eisenhower-type appeal from his famous speeches in the end of his administration. So I thought those were themes the president and his administration can work on over the next year.
And finally, Libya, the war that's apparently not a war, according to the White House. U.S. operations there do not constitute, quote, hostilities, and therefore the administration, they say, didn't have to ask Congress for permission to intervene in Libya. Congress obviously disagrees. A couple pivotal votes Friday.
I confess that I am genuinely puzzled by the administration's strategy here, because it's possible for clever lawyers to argue, as many on the administration side have, that the technical definition of hostilities excludes what's going on in Libya now. But as a matter of grand politics, the administration opened itself up for the kind of rebuke it received this week in the House by not bringing in the Congress from the very beginning or having some resolution of support in the first week or two when there would have been it would have been easier to get that marshaled. So I think by making this so purely an exercise of executive authority, the administration is really making it a high-stakes game politically, apart from its geostrategic effects.
James Fallows is national correspondent with The Atlantic. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rachel.